Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So, welcome to the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Lecture Series. My name is Cheryl Peach, and I'm a project scientist here at the aquarium. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to welcome two young scientists this evening, Dr. Brad Arisman and Dr. Octavio Aberto. As I told you, I actually schedule the speakers for this lecture series, and we like to provide you with a mix of scientists, from those that are quite experienced, tenured scientists, down to Octavio and Brad, who are the newly minted PhDs from Scripps and are currently postdoctoral research scholars here. They both work at the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation. Brad's a marine biologist, Octavio's a marine ecologist. And they're going to talk to us tonight about their work in the Gulf of California. I hope you'll join me in welcoming Brad and Octavio and their talk, From Mangroves to the Deep, Connecting Fisheries and Ecosystems in the Gulf of California. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. We will try to share with you some of the results that we have been getting for the last 12 years, connecting fisheries and ecosystems in the Gulf of California. But first of all, we are very grateful with several organizations and many, many people that have been supporting our research during all these years in the Gulf of California. Without this support, won't be able to present this with you. Especially Steve Drogin, that our dear friend that just passed away, and he was very kind with us, so we want to acknowledge his support. Let me start with this picture, and let me tell you also that I like the underwater photography, and every time that I show my pictures to my friends or other people, they tell me about this picture the same thing. Oh, look. It's beautiful. Look the colors of that sponges, look the colors of the sea fans, and look the color of the water. However, this is not a natural seascape. Yes, it's beautiful, but there are many, many elements that are missing, especially the big predators, the big fishes. If I was in the Gulf of California, probably 30 or 50 years ago, these will be the pictures. Pictures with jacks, with groupers, with snappers, all these top predators. But now, my pictures are like this. Many, many sites in the Gulf of California is, right now, the fish are gone. Sponges, corals are dying. And some species or some groups like the sea urchins are increasing the abundance in an amazing way. So we have passed from these pristine ecosystems to now these degraded ecosystems. And we want to explore with you, or we want to answer two very important questions. One is how we got here to these degraded ecosystems, and also if we can reverse this trend in order to recover the ecosystems or recover the natural resources that we had several years ago in the Gulf of California. And probably there are many problems or many things that are the cause why we are here or why our ecosystems are degraded. But we believe that one of the big problems is that we don't understand the connections between ecosystems and habitats. Within marine ecosystems, there are connections. Between land ecosystem and marine ecosystems are connections. And just look at this example. This is the life cycle of the Boccaccio. The larvae spend their lives in the open water, but then they come to the to the coastal habitats like the kelp forests or the eelgrass to spend their nursery time. They grow there, and then when they are adults, they move to boulder fields or the deep water caves. But we haven't understood these connections, and for that reason, most of our conservation efforts have been focused in individual and static examples. For example, we have a very huge problem with La Vaquita in the Upper Gulf of California. Most of the problems with this species, in theory, are related with the fisheries. But however, we haven't understood that this species, but also the entire ecosystem, have a lot of connections. And there is a lot of dynamics that we haven't understood in order to solve the problem. So we need to change from this individual static vision to the connected dynamic paradigm in order to solve some of these problems. For example, in the Upper Gulf of California, the changes that has suffered this region are not only affected this species. Right now, the fresh water is not reaching anymore the Gulf of California, and there are other species that are suffering these changes, and so we need to start thinking in another way. In order to understand these connections and these dynamics, we need to have a very long perspective, not only spatially, like all these dots in that map, also a long-term vision in time. So we need to monitor in all these ecosystems, the ones that I am showing here in this map, but also for several years. This will be our 12 years of monitoring data, and let me show you some of the results that we have get with this monitoring program. This is the Lugianus argentiventris, the yellow snapper, and this will be our character because it's a great species to show how all these habitats are connected. So this species start their life living in estuaries, and then they move to the rocky reefs. This is the size classes, and this is the percentage of each size class per habitat. So if you can see, or as you can see, the individuals move when they grow. First, when they have 2 centimeters in length, then they reach these beds of small rocks. We call them pebbles. And then they move to the mangrove roots. They spend between 8 and 10 months living here inside the mangrove roots. Once they grow enough, they move to the adjacent rocky reefs. They move in schools of fishes following the rocky shores. And then when they have between 2 and 3 years old, they reach the shallow and the deep rocky habitats where they are the most of, one of the most important predators on the reefs. So we need to understand these connections, but also we need to understand that all this life cycle takes time. So these little guys reach the pebbles in September, October every year. And 1 year later, in July, August, they leave the estuaries. So this is 1 year. And from these habitats, the rocky habitats outside the estuaries and the shallow rocky reefs, it's 1 year more. And from these shallow rocky reefs to the deep rocky reefs is 2 years more. So everything that happened here at the beginning of the lab will have consequences 4 years later when we see these individuals, big individuals, in the offshore reefs. We have been monitoring all these patches of mangroves in Baja Peninsula from Santa Rosalia all the way down to La Paz. And remember that or because the desert conditions in the Baja Peninsula, these habitats are small patches of mangroves that occur in bays or islands, like this one. And we go there, we count all these little guys inside the mangrove roots, and with all this information, we are able to estimate how many individuals all these patches produce and go to the rocky reefs. Just for 2007, we estimated that all these small patches produce around 135,000 individuals. Some of them, 4 years later, will be the ones that we fish and we sell in the markets. But not only the snappers use the mangroves in their life cycle. There are also blue crabs, grunts, mojarras, mullets, many, many species that use the mangroves. So if we or we got the opportunity to work with landings data, basically the fisheries catches of all these species along all this coast in the Gulf of California, and we correlated the amount of landings or the catches with the amount of mangroves that are in all these places. Guess what? When you do this correlation, you can see that when there is more mangrove, there is more landings. And probably this is very logic, but the most important thing is that every year, mangroves in the Gulf of California produce more than 11,000 tons of fisheries in the region, and these represent more than $19 million for local economies every year. Only 1 hectare of red mangrove, the one that is in contact between the water and the land, produces a total of $37,500 every year only in fisheries product. Imagine if we add the services that the mangroves provide for coastal protection or coastal filtration. So, as you can see, everything is connected. The problem is that we haven't understood this. We haven't understood that decreasing the mangrove coverage is affecting the fisheries in the entire region. Every year in the Gulf of California, in Mexico, actually, we lost 2% of the mangrove coverage for several activities. One is the shrimp farming that is putting more pollution in these ecosystems and also more sedimentations. But also urban developments, when they are not very proper management, these activities also threat mangroves ecosystems. For example, the owner of this hotel that decided to put the parking lot of the hotel where there were mangroves. Or this construction company in La Paz, where in just 1 weekend they cut off all these hectares of mangroves to start building these houses. So this is the connection thing. You can see how important is connecting the systems. But also I have another example about dynamics. And this is another very important ecosystem for commercial species in the Gulf of California. These are sargassum beds. Sargassum is a brown algae similar to the kelp forest that we can see here in California. But these species are smaller. Only can reach the tallest one of these species only can reach 6 meters in height. But this habitat is very important for species, especially the ones that are related with groupers. We have been studying this species, the leopard grouper, for many, many years. And look at the coloration of the juveniles. The coloration is very important for the camouflage of this species. The yellow, the dots, and this black bar on the head, they camouflage perfectly inside the sargassum. And we found that in warm years, when there is very few nutrients in the waters, the sargassum doesn't grow or grows very, very badly. But in cold years, when there is a lot of nutrients, La Niña years and El Niño years, the sargassum grows everywhere, everywhere. In 1999, that was one of the most recently La Niña years, we saw sargassum everywhere in the coast and also in the islands. So the recruitment or the abundance of the juveniles of the leopard grouper follows the same pattern. In warm years, there is less abundance of these little guys, and in cold years, there is a huge abundance of these juveniles. So we can see the same schematic thing in this graph. Each of these points is a year. These are La Niña years. This is El Niño years. So when there is a warm year, there is less grouper recruitment or grouper density. And when there is La Niña years, there is more groupers, juveniles. But let me tell you this. 7 years later, these juveniles will reach the commercial sizes. So instead of putting the group, the abundance of the juveniles here, we put the landings, we can see that the trend is similar, only that there is a 7 year lag. So basically, the years that had very good recruitment 7 years before, it will be a good years of fishing. But these years that had bad recruitment 7 years before, it will be bad fishing years. Why this is important? Well, just look the numbers that the fishery, the revenues that this fishery change between the bad years and the good years. It's a five-fold increase in revenues for these fisheries. The problem is that every year, doesn't matter the if it's La Niña or El Niño, we put the same fishing effort. We don't care about the bad years or the good years. So if we understand these dynamics, we should change our way to fish. Less fishing efforts 7 years later after a bad year of recruitment, or more fishing efforts after a good year of recruitment. So we haven't understood this, and we are continue doing this or putting the same effort every year. So let me give the talk to Brad, and he will continue working in this part of the life cycle of the fishes.
So that's a tough act to follow, but I'll do my best. As Octavio said, we're talking about the connection between the life cycle and just the cycles that drive ecosystems and the potential interaction or even the conflict, which our use of the resources they produce often occur. And I'm going to focus on another critical life stage, which is the reproduction of the organisms of the Gulf of California, in particular reef fishes. And even more than I'm going to focus on one particular life or one particular type of phenomenon, and that is spawning aggregations. And I think the best way to explain this to you is just to take you through a little scenario. So imagine an individual fish. This is a grouper, the leopard grouper we've been talking about. Every so often, for a few days or a few weeks each year, it will join other members of its population for migration for the purposes of reproduction. And this little video should hopefully give you an idea of that phenomenon. These spawning aggregations, as they're called, can include up to hundreds, even thousands or tens of thousands of individuals, which have migrated kilometers, tens, even hundreds of kilometers. And you can see the amount of productivity that is made from these spawning aggregations. These are the clouds of eggs and sperm which are produced. So productive, in fact, that whale sharks will feed on the nutrients and the proteins which are produced by these aggregations and the eggs that are produced. So it's a very incredible and also a very important biological phenomenon that really drives the persistence of the populations which engage in this behavior. And just to rehash, these aggregations are characterized by occurring at the same sites each year, only for brief periods, usually a few days or a few weeks at most. And it's just this very brief period which literally accounts for 100% of the entire annual reproduction of a population or species. So it's critically important. In the Gulf of California, we've been doing a lot of research on the spawning aggregations of the species which occur there, and we've been learning over the last 10 years or so that there are a number of species which do engage in this sort of behavior, and it's very variable taxonomically, from groupers, snappers, which Octavio has spoken about both of these groups, but also fishes like grunts, jacks, several species of jacks, even fishes like stingrays, manta rays, mobular rays. They will form these massive aggregations in the spring months for breeding. And after looking at this for several years, and we're still counting more and more species which engage in this behavior, it seems that there's about at least 30 species from at least 17 different families of fishes which form spawning aggregations as part of their life cycle. The one species I'd like to kind of take into more detail and to share with you some of the research we've been working on is the Gulf Corvina cynocyanothenopterus. And many of you may recognize this sort of fish if any of you are familiar with the white sea bass, which occurs right here off the beach here. It's a very close relative. But this species is endemic to the northern Gulf of California, and you can see that here in the red here. So it only occurs here and nowhere else in the world. It's a rather large fish, can live for about 10 years, grow to about 90 centimeters, weigh up to about 7 kilos. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to talk about the reproduction, which occurs from more or less about late February, early March to about May. During that season, all the individuals from the northern Gulf of California, wherever they may reside for other times of the year, will all migrate to the northernmost part of the Gulf of California, right near the town of the Gulf of Santa Clara here, and actually where the Colorado River flows into the ocean in the estuaries, the area known as the Delta. But it's actually much more specific and much more synchronized than that, in fact. So this is the spawning cycle of the species from about March to May. And we're using it represented by landings, but this does mimic the general activity of the species. And basically, it's confined to about six tides just before the new and full moons, or full and new moons, from March to May. So six total tides, and only about 4 days for each tide. So if you think about their total reproductive activity, it occurs in merely 24 total days. Now, we've been starting this year, just this spring, this spawning season, looking and investigating both the fisheries and kind of the biological processes involved with this species. And so I want to take you through a typical tide in both with respect to the movement of the fish and the behavior of the fish when spawning. So this is a close-up of, this is the Gulf of Santa Clara, the town. Here's the delta and the estuary, the Colorado River flowing down here. And these dots here are aggregations of Corvina. So for the first day of the tide, you see that there's some aggregations. They're kind of sparse. They've not yet moved up into the delta. And if you look at the females, and this is a female that was dissected. Here are her ovaries. They're white, yellow, creamy. They're robust. The females are close to being ready to spawn, but not quite ready. Changes somewhat on the second day. You see that the number of aggregations, the total number of fish have grown considerably. They're not yet, they're still remaining kind of outside the delta area or outside the estuary. The ovaries look pretty much the same. Okay, again, they're getting close to spawning, but they're just not right there. But a really incredible transformation happens somewhere between the second and the third day of the tide, where all the fish and all the aggregations become highly condensed and start moving well up into the freshwater areas of the estuaries. And when you look at the females, it's even more tremendous. All the females start to look like this. This is the same ovary, but it actually doubles in size. And so the ovaries can account for up to 16, 18, or more percent of the total body weight. And this is because of the process called hydration. So the ovaries literally fill up with water as the female prepares to spawn. And all the females you catch on the third day, the third morning, will look exactly like this. Very consistent with the synchronization of reproductive activity I was talking about. And by the third night, All the females look like this. So this is the ovary, and you can see this kind of strip of clear and yellowish liquid even pouring out. This is called ovulation, and the females are literally spawning or ready to spawn at the moments when you see them or sample them. And all the females in the third night would look like this. So it's literally a massive spawning all in one evening. By the fourth day, everything changes. The very next morning, most of the fish have disappeared. You see a few dots. A few aggregations may remain and spawn a second night. But for the most part, they've all emigrated out. They've moved back south. And most of the females you may collect will look like this. These are the ovaries, once again, and they're what is called spent females for obvious reasons. The ovaries are full of blood. They've released all their eggs. They've exhausted themselves. They're ready to move back down south and regain energy and rebuild themselves for the next tide. So that's literally how synchronized this spawning activity is. It's actually two of the 4 days. Now I want to compare this a little bit to the fishery for the Corvina, which is an incredibly important fishery for the town of the Gulf of Santa Clara, which is right adjacent to that estuary. And during the time of March to May, corresponding to the spawning season of these fish, the entire town is highly supported in terms of the revenue, in terms of the livelihood of the people, by this fishery and by the production they gain from it. And it's very diverse in terms of how people are employed by this fishery, whether it's the actual fishers, which go sample, the captains. I would call these guys throwers, because their job is they take the fish out of the boat from the net and they throw them into the truck. If someone has a better title, I'm open to that. Then the cleaners, all the fish go back to the most people's houses, where they clean and gut the fish and get them ready for the markets, to the processors and the commercial buyers, and so on and so forth. So literally the entire town is full of Corvina during these months and during these tides. And it is really a productive fishery. One boat, which may only be in the water or set a net for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, can catch up to 3 metric tons per boat with one net. And actually, they have to restrict their amount. They can't go over 3 tons or the boat will sink. So it's not how much they can catch, but they have to restrict themselves for safety. When you talk about the production per year, it's up to 4,000 metric tons per year of Corvina, which corresponds to, in the ballpark, and we're still working on the details of this, around $2.5 million, likely much more, per year in revenue for the community. And again, I want to remind you that's not, it says over the whole year, but this is restricted to just 3 months. So it's incredible. It's incredibly productive fishery. And when we review again how important that fishery is to the livelihood of the community, but then also compare it to the life cycle of the fish, we come to an astounding realization. Now, as I said before, we were thinking about the spawning activity being restricted to 4 days or 24 total days per year. But after just this first year of sampling and looking at the data, it's actually much more restricted than that. We should think of it as more as the entire fishery being based on the hopes that 12 days of reproduction each year will continue to produce enough fish to support the revenues for this entire community. So imagine the fragility and the delicate balance between the needs and the life cycles of this fish being so restricted and the needs of the community for their livelihood. Now, too often, and this is the case not only in the Gulf of California, but many parts of the world, this balance goes unnoticed, as Octavio had mentioned with respect to mangroves. This is a good example of a lack of knowledge of what is needed to maintain both a fishery as well as the life cycle and just the populations and organisms. This is the world's largest grouper, the Goliath grouper. It can reach up to 2.5 meters in length and over 450 kilos, once common in the Gulf of California. But after a commercial fishery about 10 to 15 years, the annual landings in just southern Gulf of California drop from 750 tons to less than a ton. Now I think it's 0 tons. I don't know the last time someone's seen a Goliath grouper in the Gulf of California. If you've seen one, I would like to know. And again, this is part of a larger global trend. It's estimated about 15% of all known spawning aggregations, when there's fisheries which target this reproductive cycle and this reproductive period, have disappeared completely, and at least 75% are in decline. And I want to stress to you that the effects of this not only occur in the shallow waters, the coral reefs, the rocky reefs, which we've been talking about, but unfortunately for us, or for them, it extends much, much deeper. And I say unfortunately because we became aware of this situation in the Gulf of California through actually a very tremendous and incredibly wonderful experience which we had last year, which was we were able to take a submersible down into the seamounts and the deep reefs last summer in the southern Gulf of California. This is a map to show you kind of where we went, the sites, the Marisla Seamount, and several deep reefs here over a 10-day period. And don't get me wrong, it was quite impressive. It was quite incredible. For example, this is a small wrasse, which I saw on the very first dive on the very first day. It so happens that this species has only been identified and observed one time all the way in the Galapagos Islands. But again, we saw it on the very first dive, the very first day. So this is the first report of this species. We also identified some new species. These are two new, this is a new species of identified jawfish. This is some cusk eel, which our experts in the marine vertebrates collection, we still can't figure out what this is. And just many incredible organisms, both organisms which are new to science or at least those which have not been observed or collected in the Gulf of California previously, such as many different types of invertebrate species as shown here. But what was most remarkable, as I said, was not what we saw, which was quite wonderful, but it was more what we didn't see or what was absent. And I think the best way to portray this is to put it in perspective and compare it to an area which we know is pristine. So I'd like to just show you a quick film that compares the seamounts and the deep reefs of the Gulf of California, which is an area we know is pristine. This is Cocos Island in Costa Rica, an area that's been protected from fishing for over 20 years. I've actually had the opportunity to go in a submersible in this area as well. And they're quite drastic. But I would like to mention that the things and the sites that you see in Cocos now, which make it famous, probably the biggest site for recreational diving in the world to see big animals, these are the same images which you've seen in the Gulf of California 15, 20 years ago. Okay, so we'll go down in the sub first in Costa Rica. When you submerge, this is a silhouette of several thousand large jacks. You hit the top of the seamount, hundreds, thousands of large hammerhead sharks. These same images were captured 20 years ago in El Bajo Seamount in La Paz. At 50 meters, the same thing. Thousands of catalufa or big eyes covering the reef. 200 meters, 250 meters, if anything, the density increases and the biomass increases. Incredibly productive. These threadfin bass, for instance, are just literally encrusted into the reefs. I don't think they could fit more. These are large groupers, 1 to 2 meters in length. They're there by the hundred, forming spawning aggregations, feeding on the massive productivity of these reefs. These same species, the species I showed you before, does occur in the Gulf of California. When you go down in El Bajo or the other seamounts in the southern Gulf, it's a different experience. This is El Bajo Seamount, and this is where you find the hammerhead sharks. Most of them have been removed from the habitat. Going down to the sub, this is Octavio. It's a very surreal and wonderful experience. But I think the most remarkable thing for those with perspective is the absence or what you don't see. The large predators are gone. Small planktivorous fishes. These are the similar type of big eyes. You see one or two or three, but not the hundreds you would expect, not the ones that we would expect to see from past records, replaced by trash. And so many nets, even at 300 meters, that the submersible driver was fearful of getting too close to the reef because of the problems we could have with entanglement. This is the same grouper that I showed you in the last video, which was so abundant, supporting a large commercial fishery. In 10 days of diving in the Gulf, we saw two. And this is what you see, for the most part. So we know that our impact reaches far beyond the surface waters, the sites that you can see every day, and extends well into 200-300 meters, likely more. This is as far as we went. But as we had talked about before, we have an idea of where we are and what we have become. And the bigger question is, can we reverse this trend? And that's the question we would like to believe that we can. And fortunately, we feel quite strongly that, yes, we can reverse the trend. And there are many doubters, but again, I'll say, yes, we do believe we can reverse the trend. And a great example is a place, Cabo Pulmo Marine Reserve, which is actually located just about an hour and a half's drive north of the biggest epicenter of the Gulf of California, which is Cabo San Lucas, the biggest area for exploding development and population. Just an hour and a half, 2 hours northeast, is one of the most incredible places for divers or marine environments you'll see. Octavio refers to it as literally the diamond of the Gulf. In 1995, the community decided to stop fishing because of they had observed the degradation of the area and decided to capture that resource and rebuild its health. And I'm happy to say, we're all happy to say, that 15 years later, it's a completely different environment. It's literally the baseline for a healthy marine ecosystem in the Gulf of California, where you see, once again, large predators like groupers, jacks, snappers, sharks, and I'll show you a video in a second to relay that to you. You'll notice that you've probably seen this picture before. This is the picture that Octavio showed you as if I were in the Gulf of California 20 years ago. But this picture was taken last November. So we can say with quite confidence there are places that still mirror what used to be in the greater part of the Gulf of California. And so I think we'd just like to end by showing you a video that really captures the essence of Gulf of California and the beauty that is the region. And this is from Cabo Pulmo.
Mi abuelo llegó hace 100 años a esta región. Fue uno de los buzos perleros de aquí, de Cabo Pulmo. Hace 13 años, junto con mis tíos, mi papá, mi abuelo, mis hermanos, tres hermanos, tomamos la decisión que se hiciera Parque Marino. No hay ninguna actividad de pesca comercial dentro del parque. Nadie puede anclarse, nadie puede tocar, lo cual pues ha beneficiado mucho al arrecife que está en muy buenas condiciones. Algunos son 7.111 hectáreas de mar. Lo queremos mantener así como está así, y seguirlo cuidando para que siga creciendo la comunidad de peces y la salud del arrecife. Estos peces, cuando alcanzan su talla ya madura, se salen a otros fondos cerca del parque. Es ahí donde los vecinos de las comunidades aledañas del parque los pueden aprovechar, los pueden pescar así, ahí en esos lugares, sin tener la necesidad de venirlos a pescar al parque antes de tiempo, vaya. Thank you.
conservar Cabo Pulmo así como está, para proteger las riquezas marinas para las futuras generaciones. Mi nombre es Mario Castro.
Paco Castro.
Luis Castro.
David Castro.
Brian Castro.
David Castro.
Dice la de Castro Díaz.
And with that, we'll thank you. And with that, we'd be happy to take any questions. Yes. The question was, have we ever given the presentation in Santa Clara? Yes. We are working directly with the Gulf of Santa Clara community. We've given as many frequent updates of what we're finding. They're directly involved in all facets of this project in terms of, because our idea is literally to fill them with as much information that they can arm themselves to decide how for themselves they can best manage this fishery. That's our objective. And so we've been giving them reports and summaries, putting posters around the town, doing our best to communicate in real time what we're finding, because it's exciting. So the question was, how often do they spawn? Do they spawn just once, I guess, in their lifetime, or multiple times in their lifetime and multiple times each year? This is the first time. We'd have to track the fish. I would assume that fish may return, the same fish may return every few weeks, but it's quite possible that the individual fish may, at different tides, we are suspecting that another alternative thing that may be happening is that maybe different stocks from different parts of the Gulf go in at different tides.
Not yet, no.
We don't know. So we're going to do some genetic work because there could be some, maybe some temporal differences. Maybe this part comes to the first tide, another side, we don't know. The second one, I would, based on what we know from other croakers, is what the family it's in, I would suspect that they live 10 years, and I suspect most fish will reproduce each year. The question was the work in Cabo Pulmo and the protection of Cabo Pulmo, is that the work of mainly one family? And how are they enforcing it? And how is it doing now?
Yeah, the grandfather of this guy, Mario Castro, was the one that settled in Cabo Pulmo almost 100 years ago. So the family Castro is the most traditional family in the town. Actually, it's a very small town. There are other people, other business, but probably there are no more than 300 persons down there. And the family Castro is the most activist in the area.
How is it enforced?
They enforce the area, but right now, after all these 13 years with protection, the area is a marine park. It's a federal marine area. The first 5 years, they had a lot of problems, especially with the surveillance. Right now, the government and the locals work together to protect the area. There is no an enforcement, a regular enforcement, but they try to do the best. I think it's one of the things that we need to solve very quickly, especially because right now, after 13 years, you can see the benefits of half for the protection of an area.
So the question was, what type of participation or what level of cooperation do we have from the government, private sector, developers, in terms of our efforts to try to replenish or reestablish the health? Actually, we're quite happy. We actually, especially for the Corvina, we're working directly with the government of Mexico, the fisheries sector. They are very interested in working with us directly, and they want to create a sustainable fishery. So it's been quite nice. In general, from all the way from the local fishermen in the communities all the way up to the government, we're getting a high level of participation and interest. So it's quite rewarding. So the question was, there was an observation that, and this is quite true, that the Japanese commercial fleet used to enter the Gulf of California for decades. As to whether that's still occurring now, Octavio, you may be the best to...
I don't have information about that. I think they don't. They don't fish right now inside the Gulf, but probably for a squid. For a squid, they have been working in the area, but I am not sure about that.
So the question was, is there a difference in the quality of the fish, the corvina, in terms of the females before and after spawning? I assume you mean the quality of the meat, so for markets? I don't think so. I know it's not reflected, I don't think, in changes in market value. Now, there has historically been a change in market price because the market gets so flooded so fast. And this is a general problem with aggregation fisheries, is that they catch so much so fast that the demand goes way down, and literally they can ask people to stop fishing or they give them almost nothing. In some cases, they've caught so many corvina that the price gets so low they can't sell them even if they want to. But they are working on, and they started this year, working on kind of a better price fixing to regulate that, to keep from overfishing and wasting the resource. So, okay, that was the best question of the night, and the one I know I can't answer fully, but I'll take a shot. So he asked, how long will it take for the ecosystem to fully recover? I don't know, but what we do know is that after 14 years in Cabo Pulmo from a system that was just like many of the other places that we see, 15 years ago, it's quite remarkable. And we even got to dive with tiger sharks. I mean, I've been diving in the Gulf for about 12 years, but I know many people most people have not seen in the last 10, 12 years big tiger sharks swimming in the Gulf. And so I think that's a sign that even the top, uppermost predators, the biggest animals, are returning. So that's maybe 15 years. So the question, what was the general condition of the delta of the estuary? I'm not at all an expert on that. I knew the general idea is that, as we most of us know, that for a while the Colorado River flow was zero into the Gulf. And now it's more of it's a trickle. And in El Niños, it's a stream. So in general, it's way down in terms of the freshwater input. I mean, it takes a long way, and there's a lot of people extracting water before it gets to the Gulf of California. But and I assume, I'm not an expert on pollution as well, but I know if the water's traveling from Colorado all the way through Las Vegas, San Diego, and all the parts in between, I can't imagine it's in its most pristine form. But I am not an expert at all. Yeah, so there's a question about our summer plans.
Well, 10 years ago, we visited all the sites that you saw in the map. And this year, we will try to repeat all these, all the samples that we did 10 years ago. During that field trip 10 years ago, we were 4 people, and we had to travel for 4 months to sample in all these sites. This year, we want to be more fancy or
efficient.
And we are trying to get a liveaboard and get all this or consolidate this team of 18 researchers to go to all these sites and do all the work in a month and be more efficient. So these are the plans for July.
So the question was, does the government of Mexico have any interest in replanting mangroves where they've been lost? And definitely.
Yes, there have been several plans, but the problem is that it's very difficult. There have been a lot of efforts in several parts, especially Sinaloa, that is where there are very big coastal lagoons. But again, it takes several times. It seems that the maturity of a mangrove ecosystem is around more than 50 years. So, and the cost, it's very expensive to do this. So probably it's better to preserve them than recover them.
The question was whether it seems that the fish population is recovering, but how is the reef doing? So that's a great question. It points out something important. Kapalpulmo was made famous in some part by Jacques Cousteau, calling it the aquarium of the world. And then it became famous because it was considered the northernmost coral reef in the eastern Pacific. And again, I've only just started working there. But from the video and from what the Castro family says, the difference between the health of the reefs, the corals, the invertebrate community, the benthos in general, is much more healthy than it was in the past. And I know that it's, as you saw in the video as well, it's brilliant. I haven't seen a healthier reef anywhere in the Gulf either. So that's my best answer, but I think it's doing quite well.
I want to thank both of you for a wonderful presentation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.